Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, another hour of Why Aren't You Catholic? One of our real favorites here, where we get to talk to non-Catholics about why they have not accepted the Catholic faith. I mean, a lot of people are like, well, I never even thought of it. So obviously, part of our motive, our sneaky motive, is to get you to think about it. Like, maybe you should be Catholic. But if you think about it and you go, well, I've got a good reason to not be Catholic and I'd like to tell them about it, then we're very, very happy to take your call. And it can be anything from I don't believe in God to, you know, I'm perfectly happy practicing the Shinto or whatever. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Why aren't you Catholic? Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Joe is the author of several very fine books, but he's got a— you mentioned that you were going to send somebody an electronic copy of your upcoming book. So why don't you just tell us about that again? Because I might have forgotten. It's almost out? Like, it's about to be released?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's going to come out in January, but I'm a terrible person when it comes to keeping track of anything like that. But it's done. I mean, we're just making sure there's no, like, obvious glaring errors right now. The book is called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. And the premise is basically this. Like, if you think the Catholic Church is wrong, you either think Jesus was wrong or you think Jesus was right, but somewhere along the way, the church strayed from the teachings of Jesus. So obviously, if your issue is the first one, that's not the book for you. But if your issue is the second one, where you think, I accept Jesus, I like the teachings of Jesus, but I don't think the Catholic Church is getting them right, well, great. Now we have a historical kind of claim, because you have to say, you know, either no one ever got it right or they got it right and then somewhere along the way, they got it wrong. So let's look at that somewhere along the way and see if those theories really stand up to any historical scrutiny.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit. I think it was John Henry Newman who said to study history is to cease—
to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant.
Yeah. I don't know that that's exactly true. There are good Protestant historians, but the thing is that history, the if you actually follow, you know, in the year 10, this happened, in the year 20, this happened, and you continue with what we know about the history of the early church, and then just continue on decade by decade to today, you just never see. I mean, there's no great disruption with Constantine. There's no great disruption with some early apostasy. The practices don't change. The books of the Bible don't change. So I see what Newman is saying there.
Yeah, I think, in fact, if you read him in context, like, that line is part of a much broader thing. And he was a brilliant Anglican scholar before he became Catholic. So he doesn't just mean, like, you know, you pick up the early church fathers for the first time, you find out Ignatius talks about the real presence, and you're done. He means something a little deeper than that. And he points out that increasingly Protestants even then were moving to this idea of, well, you got the apostles, you've got maybe a couple generations after them, maybe you get Augustine, and then suddenly you're at the Reformation. And it's like, hold on, didn't you just jump over 1,500 years?
Yeah.
What was going on in those 1,500 years? And are you claiming those people were Protestant or not? And increasingly, Protestants don't even pretend that Protestantism was visible, was anywhere in the world in the 1,500 years leading up to the Reformation.
Right.
Well, that's 3/4 of the church's history. That's a big problem. Like, if you say Jesus founded the church, but for 3/4 of our history, we didn't get it right, that raises some questions about, do we have it right today? Because it's not like on little issues. Like, the Protestant claim is that the church got things wrong on some pretty big issues, including the role of the church.
Yeah.
So it explores a little bit of that, looking specifically at 4 major issues. What did the church believe about the Eucharist and about the Mass? What did the church believe about how you became saved? What did the church believe about the structure of the church itself? And was it optional, or was it something given to them by God? And then finally, what did the church believe about which books belonged in the Bible? And specifically,
I can't
the
wait
Gospels.
To read this. I cannot wait to read it. Very good. Very good, Joe. All right. Well, let's get back to some folks who are not Catholic. I want to tell us why they are not Catholic. Up next is Sarah in Kentucky, listening to EWTN Channel 130 on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Sarah, thank you very much for waiting patiently for us. Why aren't you Catholic?
Yes, well, I was a Catholic, and I actually chose to leave the church. So, and it's not for some great theological reason. I joined the church as a teenager because I love the history and the tradition, that I felt like I was learning and et cetera. But what I have found, and as I said, it's really not a theological reason, is just a real lack of community. I've moved. I don't have children. I've moved multiple states, probably every 2 to 3 years. And I've never been to a parish that had a sense of community where I could meet people, particularly, you know, people that were working and professionals, et cetera. They seem to have some offerings for children, some for senior citizens, and nothing else. You show up to Mass and you go home. The other issue that I had, and this was probably what pushed me out the door, is it seems in our ever secular world, you know, particularly in the United States, that there's nothing. I almost wish someone would put something on the door of what we believe. You know, that's really what I was looking for, because I never heard from any of the parishes I went something I could put my teeth into in day-to-day living, and how to, you know, here's all these secular vices or things that I'm seeing, and I just saw nothing from the church. I saw no guidance on the day-to-day realities of living in the United States with things that the church says that you shouldn't have, that you shouldn't be doing. And even to this day, I don't see the church making statements anywhere.
Oh, Sarah,
so
okay.
It really kind of pushed me out.
All right, let's get Joe's response, and I'll come back to you, Sarah. Thanks.
Well, first of all, I'm really sorry for the way you've been treated. I'm really sorry for feeling like alone in the parish. That should never happen. And I know that's a lot of the experience of a lot of people. And in some places in the U.S., probably more the norm than the exception. And it's a problem that we, I think, as a community, need to work on to make it feel more welcoming. And it's hard to do. You know, we try to do it with things like greeters. And that's good as far as it goes. But I think we need more. Like, it needs to be something where, as individual Catholics, we have that sense of community. I don't know if the solution is more, you know, parish programs. I think the solution is more a community sense of ownership, that we need to be inviting people in. Like the Jews in the Old Testament take hospitality very seriously. You look at the way Abraham greets the angels in the book of Genesis and so on from there. Like, you need to treat people with hospitality very seriously. And we sometimes treat that as kind of a trivial bit of etiquette, where no, it really is connected to virtue. It really is connected to living holiness. So I'm sorry that was not lived well in your experience. I won't ask you what diocese or anything. I would say that, thanks be to God, is not universally the experience. You can find good churches. In some places it's harder to do than others. You can find churches where you have more of that sense of community. And I think you can also be part of the solution by just saying, this is my church too. Like, you're a baptized Catholic. You're one of us. And just say, like, how do I make other people feel more at home in that? Because I think you're absolutely right that in a lot of places, everything is kind of structured for retirees or for children. And for everyone else, it can be a little difficult. But things like, for instance, the parish just 5 minutes from here has a fantastic mothers group that meets every week. And it's been such a tremendous aid to stay-at-home moms who are trying to live the faith and maybe don't get a lot of adult interaction. You know, those kind of things. But that's not something where the pastor's leading it. That's something where the moms are just putting in the time and effort and the sweat and making it happen. And I don't know that there's a solution other than that the people who feel really called and convicted there, if we don't step up, nobody else is going to. So I think that's the first thing. On the second one, I wanted to get a little clarification about what you mean about day-to-day living. Do you mean that you could use more like, here's guidance in terms of spirituality and how to live a prayer life well? Do you mean like political things or social issues, or what is it that you were looking for and not finding specifically?
I think just, and not necessarily from our priest, but probably from the priest at the time where I was going, it just seemed to be, and then going on up. For example, any of the myriad of social issues that you see today that are just seen as fine, any of the ones that the church, I feel like historically, has been very open about that this is wrong. I just feel like we just don't talk about it anymore.
Do you mean things like abortion?
Well, I think abortion, but I think there's so many more. You know, it used to be, I mean, you could go down the list.
Did you feel like you get, or do you feel like you get clearer moral teaching in your Protestant church than in the Catholic church?
Yes, absolutely.
Got it.
Someone is not scared to stand up and say, you should not be looking at pornography.
I see what you're saying. I'm following you now.
Should be leader of the home, that kind of thing.
Right.
Homosexuality is...
Right, right.
And I just never heard that from the Catholic Church.
You know what, Sarah? I would say this. It's kind of, your question is funny in a certain way, and please don't mishear what I'm saying there. Just because so much of the world criticizes us for allegedly constantly talking about those things, but then you'll find pockets where the preaching just kind of conspicuously avoids it. I do think younger clergy tend to be a little bolder about speaking into that. I also think there's a certain pastoral sensitivity to the fact that it's much easier to have those hard conversations one-on-one than in front of a couple thousand people, particularly maybe sensitive sexual topics when there might be a lot of children present. It's very hard to know, how do we talk about something like pornography in front of a mixed company? You know, like that's tricky to do. And so I want to both respect the difficulty there, that there's a reason why some priests really struggle to drive that home, or maybe they speak a little too obliquely about it. They're maybe a little better about it in the confessional than they are at the pulpit, because they're able to do a little more, they can be a little more open about the details of it without scandalizing anyone. But at the same time, I think you're right that there is a need to preach on those issues. But that really isn't a... to put it this way, that's not really a church-level problem. That's an individual priest or parish-level. You know, like maybe that's an issue where you talk to the pastor and say, you know, I think we really could use a homily on X, Y, or Z, and maybe he would be open to some words of encouragement, or maybe you'd find someone who preaches that a little more fervently down the street. Certainly, you can find Catholics online. You can find statements from the USCCB and other Catholic sources. You can find papal statements about all of those issues and really explicitly kind of acknowledging where the problems are with those, you know? So I don't know if that helps. There's not a lot that we can do about the fact that, like, maybe your local parish is a little too lukewarm, or maybe the preaching isn't what you would like it to be.
Could I just add, Joe, however, that, like you said, it's not a church-wide problem, but one thing that is a church-wide problem is since about the 1960s, there has been an internal struggle in the Catholic Church that we should be honest and open about, where bishops argue with other bishops, priests argue with other priests, Catholics argue with other Catholics about what should be the messaging, so to speak. And we have a serious messaging problem in that. I mean, right now, the U.S. bishops are, frankly, as divided as you, I mean, not divided in the sense that huge numbers are on each side, but they're very divided about how you should talk about even things like politicians who are supportive of abortion. They just can't settle it. And so there is an unsettledness in the Catholic Church that I think you would not have gotten before the sexual revolution of the 1960s.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. I think the other thing worth pointing out here is that when Protestants are at that ill ease with one another, there tends to just be a schism, and like they go off and form different groups. Yeah. And so then you can find the preacher who says the things you want them to say, who really convicts other people and the sins they've got. Or you can find the preacher who goes in the opposite direction. With the Catholic Church, it really is, you know, James Joyce called it, here comes everybody. But you'll find, you know, people who are very convicted of the teachings of the church. And unfortunately, you know, there's wheat and weeds in the church. There are people who have both legitimate disagreements, but also sometimes they just don't seem to believe everything the Catholic Church believes and teaches. And so that is a real problem. I am admittedly blessed. I live in the archdiocese where the head is, you know, Archbishop Naumann is the head of the pro-life committee for the USCCB. So we don't have the particular problem Sarah's talking about. But I know a lot of places do, where maybe the bishop doesn't speak out as he should. maybe the priests don't feel comfortable speaking out as they should. I think that's a problem with courage, maybe, as much as anything else. And I do think the best thing that can happen there is some polite but forceful kind of encouragement.
Sarah, I got to leave it there because we got to take a break. As a matter of fact, I'm late for the break, but that was such a great conversation. I didn't want to leave it. Thank you very much for the call. We'll go to Al in Cleveland when we get back. We've got to take this very quick break.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
By providing quality programming faithful to the teachings of the Catholic Church, EWTN is television that viewers can trust. Whether it's films, documentaries, news coverage, lively discussion shows, or kids' programs, we highlight the truth that is the eternal Word. For a complete schedule of EWTN television programs, visit EWTN.com and click TV. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Lots of great conversations today, Joe. I really enjoyed talking with non-Catholics, and it seems like people really want to be polite, and you don't have to be quite so polite with us. Like, we can take it if you disagree with us, but people have been very nice about the way they phrased it. You know, like, I believe you are pagan sun worshipers, but I want to say that in the nicest way possible. But you don't have to be nice to us.
We've got a lot of Midwesterners and Southerners who are kind of, I don't want to, you know,
nicer than the rest of the country. No, that's what you're going to say. Yeah, I know.
You know, it's like an Oreo. Nobody goes for the outer edges. It's the middle. That's where the best parts are.
Al in Cleveland, thank you for being patient, listening on The Rock. Oh, I love The Rock in Cleveland. As a matter of fact, I got a Rock t-shirt. Al, go ahead with, why are you not Catholic?
Well, am I on the air?
You are on the air.
You are.
Oh, okay. Well, I am Catholic. And I just want to say glory to Jesus Christ and to everybody who's listening. If you're not Catholic, get in the church. And I encountered somebody today, and I know him from the street. He's a black gentleman, and I tried to give him a little holy card, and it had a picture of Jesus, like, with his Sacred Heart. And he said, I want nothing to do with white Jesus. He said, Jesus is black. And that was, like, the end-all conversation, you know?
Oh.
And it's like, well, how is he going to come into a Catholic church? And I told him, I have an image of the Black Madonna, Our Lady of Czechoslovakia, Black Jesus. It's a Polish image. Many people are probably familiar. But he just, like, wouldn't hear it, you know? Like, unless you acknowledge that Jesus Christ was this racial, you know what I mean? Like, this race, then I'm not going to.
So it's funny because he wasn't really rejecting Jesus. He was rejecting the depiction of him as white.
Yeah.
Joe, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is an actual issue within some aspects of the African-American community. There's, didn't think I'd ever have an opportunity to quote Kanye West, but Kanye West in Jesus Walks says, I'm not here to argue about his facial features or trying to turn atheists into believers. He's referring to the fact that within the African-American community, there was a real resentment of the presentation of Jesus consistently as white, that this was viewed as a tool of white supremacy and racial oppression, and a kind of reclaiming of Jesus as black. And I think the honest answer is, historically speaking, both of those are wrong. I mean, he lived in first century Judea and probably looked like other first century Judean Jews, because that's the stock and lineage of which he was. So brown is probably more accurate than white or black, but I think more importantly, it doesn't matter. That this obsession with skin color and this obsession with race is not found in the New Testament and is totally repugnant to the message of the gospel. So look at, for instance, the epistle to the Romans about Jews and Gentiles, and, like, just get over it. You know, like, that Jesus is bigger than all of that. Another place to look, I would say, Pope Pius XI has an encyclical. Now, I know if someone's not ready to accept, you know, even like a holy card of Jesus on it, and they're not Catholic at all, they're not going to be like busting out an encyclical of Pius XI. But I think it's worth reading and reflecting on what he has to say, since it sounds like you are Catholic. But in his encyclical, Mit Brennender Sorge, It's spelled like Sorge, but pronounced like with a Z. Pius XI stands up to the Nazis. And one of the things he accuses them of is taking race and kind of elevating it to this divine status, making an idol of skin color, of race. And just that this is absurd because it ignores the fact that God is a God of all creation. He's a God of the entire world. So we're all made in the image of God, regardless of the melanin content or, where your continent of origin is in terms of family history. Like, those are insignificant issues in the face of the brotherhood of man, in the face of like all being sons and daughters of God through adoption. Like, that's the actual message. Like, the familial origin stuff is trivial and meaningless. And meaningless, not in the sense that there aren't real wounds there. Meaningless in the sense that that's just not where it's at in terms of the Christian message. So, well, I don't know if that helps at all. But I think the other thing maybe is to be really forthright and acknowledge the fact that, a lot of times Christians, white Christians particularly, treated African-Americans, including many black Christians, very, very poorly. And, even this is true in Catholicism, this is true in Protestantism, Northern and Southern Baptists split because Southern Baptists wanted to affirm the right to own slaves. Like, that's what the Southern Baptist Convention was born in, its embrace of one of the most abhorrent evils in human history. That kind of thing is part of our history collectively as American Christians. And I think we can acknowledge that and still say they were wrong to be obsessed with race, and we're wrong to be obsessed with it today if we're treating it as something more important than our status as sons and daughters of God.
Thanks, Al. I'm going to keep moving on that one. Thank you very, very much for the question. Why aren't you Catholic is our topic, and I'm going to move to Hassan in Washington, watching on Facebook. Hassan, you there with us?
Yes.
Why aren't you Catholic? All right, that sounded accusatory. Sorry. Why aren't you Catholic?
I'm really sorry for size behavior.
I just got the tone wrong. That's all. The question's all right. I just got the tone wrong.
I know, Si. I've been listening to him for a while. So.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay, good.
So thank you for taking my call. And why am I not Catholic? But first of all, because of a lot of Catholic teachings that I read about, I can't really find them in the Bible as hard as I've tried. But, we all claim to say that. Secondly, is I've been listening to a lot of, maybe all of the debates that James White has done with different Catholic scholars, and I've tried to listen honestly. But to me, he has proven without a doubt that the dogmas that the Catholic Church believes were not present at all in the early church, beginning with Peter as Pope. I just listened today with his debate with Mitch Pacwa, and just proved to me that that's not what the early church believed about the papacy. So,
yeah, okay. So James White convinced you that Catholic doctrine is wrong.
Well, I was convinced, but then I tried to listen and see.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so you gave the Catholics a fair hearing. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's very praiseworthy. I like that you are trying to listen with an open mind and an open heart. And I like that you're calling into this show. I think there's a lot that's very good about the openness that you have there. I think I'd say a few things. Number one, James White is an excellent debater. And he often, I think, is a better debater than the people that he is up against, because even if they're very smart, there's a difference between being very smart and very well-informed and being a great debater. And White really knows the art of debate in a way that I see him on things where I know he's wrong and still think that he makes a great case just because he's very skilled. I say that as a former debater myself, as a former lawyer, that there you can make a bad position look right with a lot of skills. I don't think he does that with bad faith. I don't mean to ascribe any kind of malice to him. I just mean to say I see what you mean, but I don't think that actually translates him into him being actually the one who is correct. Second, in terms of the origins of the papacy, since that's the one issue you mentioned, I'll have you know I actually wrote a book on that exact issue called Pope Peter. And the argument there is that, yeah, Peter has this special role in the early church. Now, does that look exactly like it looks for Pope Francis? Of course not. Leadership doesn't look the exact same in every situation, in every context. But the actual thing Catholics believe, as opposed to kind of the caricature, is found in Scripture. So just to give maybe one example, since I know we're going to listen to other, you know, other callers want to get in as well. But at Luke 22, the disciples are debating which of them is the greatest. And we often kind of look at this and laugh because we're like, oh, they're always debating about this. But Jesus doesn't ever criticize this. He wants them to want greatness, I think, because he doesn't tell them stop wanting greatness. He tells them how to get it. So if you would, I'll actually return to this and kind of unpack Luke 22 a little bit more, because I know we have to go to the break. But I want to look at Luke 22 and say, what does it have to do with St. Peter, with the papacy, and with kind of the evidence for the core Catholic claim?
Hang on, if you will, Hassan. We'll be right back with more with Joe Heschmeyer on Why Are You Not Catholic?
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Tomorrow on More to Life, Liar, Liar.
Lies hurt. We'll help you heal from the pain of betrayal and respond to the hurt gracefully.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Our topic this hour, why aren't you Catholic? And non-Catholic folks calling and telling us why they are not Catholic. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. He's the author of Pope Peter and a bunch of other books. And we were actually just talking about Pope Peter because the question from Hassan in Washington, or really his answer to our question, is he's not Catholic because he doesn't believe in the Catholic doctrines, particularly around the Pope. And Joe, go ahead and continue with your conversation with Hassan.
Yeah, so the biblical argument I was kind of exegeting was Luke 22. And it's at the Last Supper. There's a dispute among the disciples about which of them is to be regarded as the greatest. Rather than discouraging this, Jesus explains what Christian greatness looks like. He says that the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them. Those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Let the greatest among you become as the youngest and the leader as one who serves. And then he gives himself as the standard for what that looks like. And he says, I'm among you as one who serves. And then he affirms the actual leadership that these 12 have. He says, you are those who've continued with me in my trials. As my Father appointed a kingdom for me, so do I appoint for you. You may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. In other words, the Christian model is one of what we would call servant leadership. And the authority of the Church, this enduring role of the apostles, is one that lasts not just in, you know, a few years or the first century or the first generation, but is a thing that lasts for all time, that the 12 will continue to have this role even into the coming kingdom as they'll, you know, judge the 12 tribes of Israel. So within that, having just identified the model for leadership is, you know, I'm among you as one who serves, this idea of servant leadership, he then identifies one out of the 12, Simon Peter. And he says to him, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you all, that he might sift you all like wheat. But I have prayed for you. Now he switches from the plural you to the singular you, that he wants all 12 of you. But I prayed for you. Now we're individual. That your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brethren. This is a remarkable kind of passage because he's just said there's this demonic assault on all 12 of the apostles. And rather than just saying, I am the second person of the Trinity, I'm God-man, I'm going to just stop this from happening, rather than saying, I'm going to pray for all 12 of you, rather than any of the ways that Jesus could have approached this problem, he chooses to solve it through the person of Simon Peter and tells him, strengthen your brethren. In other words, immediately after having just said, to lead is to serve, he then tells one of them that he's in charge of serving the others, just as they're in charge of serving the church, that he's made Peter the servant of the servants of God. That's the understanding of the papacy. Not that the Pope should boss everybody around like a Gentile overlord. Jesus is very clear, that's not it. That rather is to be a servant of the people of God, and then a servant of those serving the people of God. That's the understanding. And included within that, from the earliest days of the church, we see people turning to the Bishop of Rome to figure out what he believes and viewing communion with him and communion with his beliefs as being a really central part of the Catholic thing. And we see that in a couple of ways. Now, I mentioned the scriptural ones, so let me give you just two quick historical ones. First, you have the letter called First Clement in 96 AD, roughly thereabouts, while the Apostle John is still alive. The Corinthians have had an issue with an internal dispute in the church, and rather than writing to the living apostle, they write to the Bishop of Rome, who writes back and settles the issue. That gives us a clear impression that the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, has this really important, really central kind of role. But additionally, I would say, when you get to the arguments that Irenaeus makes against heresies in 180 AD in Book 3, I mentioned earlier that he talks about apostolic succession. The reason that he says that he traces the lineage of bishops from Peter on down in Rome as opposed to everywhere else is because he says it's a matter of necessity that every church should agree with this church on account of its preeminent authority. That he's recognizing this special place the successor of Peter has in the Bishop of Rome. And this is in the second century. This is extremely early on. So I would say you can find that all throughout the writings of the early church fathers. You find it in people like St. Optatus of Milevis. You find it all over the place, Augustine as well. So I would say that the idea that this is some later thing, it's very hard to sustain historically.
Hassan, I'm going to leave it there, but I would like to offer you Joe's book, Pope Peter, if you'd because you said you have an open mind, you like to consider these things. If you'd like to consider it, we'll send you a free copy of Pope Peter. Just hang on the line, and Thomas will get your information, and we'll send it to you. Why aren't you Catholic is our question today. We've had so many good calls, I feel kind of spoiled. But we do have three lines open. If you want to call right now, you are welcome. And if you want to tell us why you're not Catholic, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Right now, we'll go to Tom in Baltimore, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Tom, thank you. Why aren't you Catholic?
Well, actually, I am Catholic, but as I told the screener, I'm considering leaving the church with, frankly, a great deal of sadness. So maybe I should give you some background of how I got here and all that. My wife and I have been married for 49 years, and the first roughly 30 years of the marriage, we kind of drifted from one Protestant church to the other, mostly Methodist. And, you know, the sermons there just never clicked, never got to any meat that we could, you know, feel like it was something we could really put in our pocket and carry with us. In fact, as an example, one time I asked the pastor at one of the churches, why don't you ever talk about abortion? And he says, because if I do, I have to give everybody here a way out, no matter what they believe. And so I'm like... Whoa. So we came to the Catholic Church about 20 years ago. And frankly, the first day I was here, I said, man, this is the place, because, you know, the homilies were about important issues of the day and got to the important topics and things. You know, I was always a believer that when I walk out the door on Sunday morning of the church, if I'm always feeling really good about myself, I'm not hearing probably what I need to hear. I don't feel like I should walk out wanting to slit my wrist, but no. I don't feel like I should always be all happy and think, man, I'm doing okay here.
You know? So after that experience, I'm gathering you no longer are having that experience. Are you thinking there's a decline in preaching or in the Catholic Church?
Absolutely. We went through the RCIA 20 years ago, and over that 20 years, my wife and I have both seen a consistent decline in the willingness to approach difficult topics, and to become, and the homilies have become more and more vanilla, I would say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have one young priest in our parish that daily mass, he talks about the saint, when they were born and when they died and their life, without ever referring to the scripture or any practical application.
Yeah.
Frankly, you know, I feel that, you know, I'm almost wasting my time. I'm there for the Eucharist, no matter what the guy on the altar has to say for the homily, you know.
Right, but the preaching is important. I'm going to let Joe respond, but do you attribute this to anything? Like, to what do you attribute the decline in preaching that you've experienced?
Well, not to be cynical, but frankly, I call it preaching to the collection plate.
Okay.
You don't want to offend anybody. You want to keep the money coming in. And right now, what we're doing is parish shopping. We're looking around for a parish that has someone, you know, a pastor that's not afraid to talk about the difficult things. And sadly, if that doesn't happen, I may be moving on.
Joe?
Yeah, I would just say, you said it earlier, like, you've got the Eucharist, you get the flesh and blood of Jesus Christ. In comparison to that, I mean, I just point out that for a lot of the history of the church, you would regularly have no preaching at the Mass. It would just be the prayers themselves would stand on their own. Like, I would encourage you in that direction. Like, a good homily, be attentive to it. Let the priest open up the Word of God to you. Be transformed by it. But don't rely on it, because you're relying on this distinctly human element of the Mass. Meaning, like, the strength of the homily depends more on human effort than any other part of the Mass. The preset parts, like, you listen to the actual prayers of the Mass and learn to, like, pray those, and then learn to receive Jesus and really receive Jesus. In Exodus 16, the Israelites wandering in the desert are complaining that they're not getting fed and they're missing the flesh pots of Egypt. And the response is manna from heaven. That's how God kind of answers this issue. Like, we have the true bread from heaven. And I know it is unfortunately true and will always be true that there are pockets of the church where you find bad preaching. That's always been the case. It will always be the case. It may be worse in some eras than others. Speaking personally, I find the preaching in my own neck of the woods so far better now than it was 20 years ago. But if you've had the opposite experience, that's unfortunate. And, you know, there's not a lot we can do about that. I mean, there's a lot they could do, maybe. But I've had bad homilies. I've had people who run on in much the way I'm running on right now. But I would just say, learn to pray the Mass itself. Recognize the profound reality that God is making himself present, and accept no substitutes. Like, the difference between that and a memorial service for Jesus is night and day. It's the difference between infinity and human effort. Like, all other religious worship, on some level, is man's attempt to reach out to God. And in the Mass, you have God giving himself to man. That is a night and day kind of difference. And if there's a good homily to go along with it, that's gravy on top. But if there's not, oh well, you know, like, hopefully we can just ignore the homily and get to the Eucharist in a real and profound way.
I'm going to have to leave it there. Tom, I don't know that we could add much to that in any case, but we also have to take a break, and there's a couple more folks on the line. Probably we could get to one more caller if somebody wants to get in there and tell us why you are not Catholic. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. John in Utah, you're coming up right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Overseas abortion. A court ruling threatens to diminish people with disabilities. And remembering a saint. We hear more about one of the most beloved figures in the Catholic faith today.
Clear, concise, Catholic. EWTN News Nightly with Tracy Sable. Tonight, 9 Eastern on EWTN Television and Radio.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We got the store-wide sale going on, and I haven't mentioned it enough today, so I'll probably get in trouble tomorrow. But it is a really good sale. It's over at shop.catholic.com, and I think the idea there is everybody figures people are going to do their Christmas shopping early, so we wanted to have a nice early sale so you can get what you want and then also get it delivered. It doesn't matter what you buy. Buy one book, buy 100 books. It's $5 flat rate shipping everywhere in the continental United States. Just go to shop.catholic.com. Stuff on sale, 10, 25, 50, in some cases more than 50% off. Shop.catholic.com. I got a little excited there at the end. Sorry about that. Our number is 888-318-7884. Our question to callers today, instead of accepting questions, we're asking a question. And that question is, why aren't you Catholic? And if you're not Catholic, I'll tell you what, I'm pretty sure we could get you on if you give us a call right now. We got a couple folks ahead of you, but there's enough time to get you on. 888-318-7884. We're going to go now to John in Utah, watching us on YouTube. John in Utah, do we have you there?
Hi, how's it going?
Very well, thank you.
I've been a person who's been watching sort of other talking call-in shows. I've been on a sort of soul search for the last year and a half.
Okay.
In terms of what I believe, and for me, what I find most important is truth and claims of scientific relevance. Like, I'm sure there's better ways to word that. But I came across this show, and I'll be honest, I really haven't watched much, but it made me realize how little of Catholicism has been in my life. I live in Utah. I've grown up here my whole life, and I've been surrounded by Protestants and Mormons. I think they still fit into Protestants, but I'm not too sure.
Yeah. Okay.
So I just wanted to learn and share, and I guess the answer of the question is, why am I not Catholic, is I have not been presented with evidence that has convinced me, if that's the easiest
that
way.
That it's true. Right. Gotcha, John. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, sorry. I think, the single best reason to be Catholic is because it's true. Everything else is just explaining kind of how we get to that conclusion. Yeah. Right. Right. And so it would be helpful for me to know just a little bit about you, maybe. Do you accept the core claims of Christianity, or are you still kind of sorting those out?
I do not. Thank you for asking. I admit that I have not read the Bible, and I do own a copy. I'm not sure if there's a difference between the Catholic and Protestant Bible, I know there's a bunch of different Bible versions. I believe my friend, who was once Mormon and is now Young Earth Creationist Protestant, gave me a New American Standard Bible. And like I said, I have not read it, but I have done research on bits and things. Obviously, I'm not going to sit here and proclaim deep knowledge of that, but the parts I have been presented have not, like, basically, sure. You know, like, I could sit here and you could help correct me about things I know, like, oh, well, here's what the historians say about Jesus living here and this and that. But for me, it comes down to, you know, I've studied, I did paleobiology in college. I've literally gone into the field of southern Utah and dug up dinosaur bones. So, I mean, maybe that fits into this belief system, but even if it does, I guess I'm maybe just distracted here, but the core claim that there's something outside of the natural world that is an entity that has created and has divine commands and such is, I just haven't seen reason to accept that personally.
Great. Oh, it's very helpful for figuring out where you're starting from. I'm going to give you a reference to something that can go more in depth on the faith and reason thing. I'll just say very briefly, we're cool with dinosaurs. We're cool with, you know, you can take different views on the age of the earth, the way on a biological level, organic and inorganic evolution, creation, all, whatever. We don't have a huge dog in that fight. Monsignor George Lemiarty, the guy who first posited the Big Bang, was a Catholic priest. So we're totally cool with that. That said, like, we don't dogmatically take a stand one way or the other on a strictly scientific question. The encyclical I would refer you to, if you want to go a little deeper on that question, is called Fides et Ratio, which is just Latin for faith and reason. So if you just look up, like, John Paul II, faith and reason, you'll find a very extended explanation of the role of faith and the role of reason and how those two things interplay. He describes them as the two wings on which the human spirit rises in the contemplation of truth. So it's a beautiful kind of ode to truth, knowing the truth about God and the truth about ourselves. But since the issue that you flagged was how do we know that there is any kind of God at all in the first place, let me just pose this to you. There's a difference between things that are contingent, meaning that, you know, they're caused by certain conditions, and things that are non-contingent. And a contingent thing, you know, requires some sort of, you know, X, Y, Z in order for it to exist. And so it only exists under certain conditions. It's, you know, that's what we mean by contingent. The universe as we find it, every specific aspect of it is contingent. You know, I wouldn't be here without my parents. I wouldn't be here without oxygen. I wouldn't be here without water. You know, I mean, radically dependent. So are you. So is everything else. Like, there is this contingency in everything that we find. But contingent things only arise under certain situations. And so you can't just have an infinite number of contingent things and that's it, because otherwise you would never have anything come into being, because you would never have the conditions arise, since the conditions are themselves contingent. So you need something or someone non-contingent. You need someone or something unlike everything we see in the universe, someone or something that exists necessarily, that doesn't have a beginning or end, because those are marks of contingency, that doesn't rely on anyone or anything else in order to exist. Do you see what I mean? So we need God or something extremely similar to God to explain why any of the universe exists in the first place. And I'm not saying that as like an intelligent designer. I'm saying just metaphysically, the fact that being continues to be requires something more than contingency.
I've heard arguments like that, and I think I wouldn't know where I stand. On one hand, I think I agree with that there needs to be, I guess, my natural, I'm very good at overthinking and very good at jumping ahead. So if something has to be contingent on something, why does there have to be something else that is somehow unable to be contingent if it doesn't go back forever, but it's the first? How is that allowed to be non-contingent? Is it because it's outside the universe? Can the universe itself be the non-contingent thing?
Those are two very good questions, very good clarifications. Think about it like a train. You know, the boxcars on a train are contingent in terms of motion. Like, they don't pull themselves, but they pull the thing behind them. So if you saw, like, let's say you approach an intersection, you just see, like, boxcars whizzing by. You don't see an engine, but you know that you wouldn't have the whole thing in motion if there wasn't some first thing driving everything. That you need something that's uncaused, that is the source of its own existence, or in that case, the source of its own motion, in order to have anything else in motion. I don't know if that clarifies it. Does that make any sense? Like, you can't just have an infinite number of contingent things, or else why do any of them exist at all?
I see what you're saying. I think I agree. I really would hate to say, oh, yes, I totally agree, because I'm still not even familiar with the question enough. I need to do more research. But it feels like I'm not, I still don't see why it's like, yes, it makes sense that this guy doesn't have a cause. His cause is to be himself, but everything behind it has to have a cause. And we can't have infinite causes, but we can have one guy, one car, who is.
So, yeah, just to clarify, I'm not making the argument that.
Polling.
Yeah. Like, theoretically, you could have another uncaused cause. Or at least based on the argument I've presented, the arguments against why you couldn't are different than the ones I've laid out. I'm just laying out the point that we see, in fact, that everything we see is contingent. That we see, in fact, that, you know, the universe is expanding and changing, that everything within the universe is contingent, only exists under certain situations. And so I'm taking the contingency of the things that we encounter as demonstrable rather than as, like, logically or metaphysically necessary in that sense. I don't know if that makes any sense. Then the other half...
I like that.
Okay, good. Then the other half of that is, you mentioned, well, what couldn't it be, the universe itself? And the short answer to that is everything present in the effects must be present in the sum of the causes, right? Like, if you, like, take the ingredients and you make a cake, there's nothing going to be in the cake that wasn't in the ingredients in some way, shape, or form. Like, maybe you've rearranged them, but you're not going to have something in the result that wasn't in the prior conditions. Is that, we track with that? Like, that's just a basic kind of logical rule?
I think, but when it's the totality of the unit, like, I guess, I'm sorry, I should clarify, when I say universe, I'm not just saying the visible universe. I would mean more, I guess, a theoretical outside the universe, or what is the cosmos, I think is a word I've heard used.
Sure,
and,
sure.
And there, it's what physicists have used to sort of help understand expansion rates and things, and... Maybe that would then be an admittance that, hey, well, now you're saying something outside the universe had to cause the universe, and then I could agree with that.
If we said, like, the multiverse or the cosmos or anything like that, the core idea, the twofold idea that contingent things need causes and you can't have just contingent things, and the idea that everything in the effects has to be present in the sum of the causes, those are just two basic kind of axiomatic, almost logical principles. And the reason I mentioned that is, like, if we can get that far, then we can say, great, what do we see in creation? We see things like intelligence. We see things like the ability to reason. We see things like love. Those things must be present in some form in the totality of causes that lead to the totality of the universe. That you can't just posit the universe as the answer to that without giving the universe a lot of agency and personality and intelligence and love and all this stuff. And once you start saying the universe has all of those things. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I just think I disagree. I think there's naturalistic reasons as to why reason and love and possibly consciousness. I won't say for sure, yes, there's a complete naturalistic response to how consciousness emerges. But I think it's more reasonable to believe that it is a natural result of, well, it could be that a god caused the universe, but I do not believe that said God is somehow responsible for, at least with outside of setting up the chain of dominoes. He's not going along and adding dominoes or maybe moving dominoes to his liking.
Yeah, but, I'm sorry, John. We've come to the end, but I want to give you a couple resources. One, if you will give us an address, give it to Thomas, I'll send you a copy of Dr. Stacy Trisankos's book, Particles of Faith, which gives a Catholic view of science and how a Catholic thinks about science. And I'd also like to just refer you to two things. One, there's a podcast called Classical Theism, which addresses much. It's by John DeRosa. It's very good. It addresses much of what Joe was describing. And I'd like to send you to the Aquinas Institute. Just look up the Aquinas Institute and look up Dr. Karen Oberg, who is a Harvard astrochemist, and get her take on the Catholic faith. We got to go, though. We'll see you next time. Catholic Answers Live.